Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is December the 11th. We are in Parshas Va'era, in our redemption class. We are on page 326, Pasuk Yudal, verse 14. Last time we had stressed the fact that there is a difference between the mata, the staff of Moshe, and the mata of Aaron. And we showed that Moshe's staff had turned into a nachash, a snake, and Aaron's staff had turned into a tanin, which is another word for some sort of snake or serpent. And we'll talk further about that this evening. And the most recent story we had was how Aaron threw down his staff. It turned into a tanin. That tanin, the sorcerers of Paro copied Aaron and showed that they could do it as well. They threw down their staffs and they turned into taninim. And then it says, Vayivra mate Aaron es matosam, Aaron's staff swallowed theirs. We pointed out that after the taninim had reverted back to being staffs, then Aaron's staff swallowed their staffs. And yet Paro hardened his heart and would not listen to them, as Hashem had predicted. So now we have the prelude to the Makkah of Dam, to the plague of blood. Vayomra Hashem Moshe, Hashem said to Moshe, Kaved leiv Paro. Paro's heart is heavy. Me'ein l'shalach ha'am, he refuses to send out the nation. Leich el Paro baboker, go to Paro in the morning. Hinei yotzei ha'maima, behold, he is going out to the water. V'nitzavtel l'krosu asfas ha'or, you shall stand to greet him at the riverbank. V'amateh shenepach l'rachash, and the staff that had turned into a snake, tikach biyadecho, you shall take in your hand. We pointed out last time that Paro was trying to give over the impression that he was divine and therefore did not need to relieve himself, and he used this morning trip out to the Nile River where he would relieve himself and no one would suspect that he would do such a thing because it would defile the river. Love, you shall say to him, Hashem Elokeho Yivrim, Hashem, the God of the Jews, Shalachani Alecha Leimor, has sent me to you, saying, Shalach Esami, send out my nation, V'yavduni Bamidbar, and they shall serve me in the wilderness. V'hine lo shamata adko, and behold, you have not listened until here, until now, or until this. Koama Hashem, thus says Hashem, Bezos Teda, with this you shall know, Kiani Hashem, that I am God. Hine Anochi Makeba Mate Asher Biyadi, behold, I am striking with the staff that is in my hand, Al Hamayim Asher Bayar, on the water that is in the river, Vinehavchu L'dam, and they will turn into blood. Vihadaga Asher Bayar Tamus, and the fish that is in the river will die, Uva'ash Hayar, and the river will spoil, it will become,
foul,
okay. Vinil umi trying lishos mai min hayor, and the Egyptians will be prevented from drinking water from the river. Vayomer, so the Torah doesn't actually narrate the story of Moshe going and doing this. Hashem tells Moshe to do it. It is understood that that is what he did. Vayomra Hashem al Moshe, Hashem said to Moshe, Emor el Aharon, say to Aaron, Kach matcha, take your staff, unete yadcha, and stretch out your hand, al meimei Mitzrayim, on the waters of Egypt, al naharosam, on their rivers, al yo'orehem, another word for rivers, which we can say rivulets, how do they say it here?
Canals,
okay. V'al agmehem, and on their lakes, v'al komikvei meimehem, and all of their gathered water, V'yudam, and they will be blood. V'hayadam b'chol eretz Mitzrayim, there will be blood in all the land of Egypt. Uva'itzim uva'avanim, and in the wood and in the stones, which means even in the utensils, the water that was in somebody's pitcher turned to blood as well. V'yasu chen Moshe v'aron, and Moshe non did so. Kasher tzivu Hashem, as God had commanded. V'yarem b'matan, he lifted with his staff. V'yach es hamayim, and he struck the water, asher b'yor, that was in the river, le'inei Pharaoh, to the eyes of Pharaoh, ulenei avadav, and to the eyes of his servants, v'yehavchu kol hamayim asher bayar ledam, and all the water that was in the river turned to blood, v'hadaga asher bayar mesa, and the fish that was in the river died, v'yivash ayar, and the river spoiled, the river became, what was the word?
Foul.
Foul, thank you. And the Egyptians could not drink water from the river. And the blood was in all of the land of Egypt. And the sorcerers of Mitzrayim did the same thing with their magic. Paro's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them. Kashedi ben Hashem, as God had spoken. Not that Hashem hardened Paro's heart, Paro hardened his own heart. Vayifen Paro turned by Avoel Beso, and he came to his house. Veloshas libo gam lazos, and he did not put his heart even to this, which means he paid no attention to it. Vayach peruch al Mitzrayim sivivos hayor mayim lishtos, and all of Egypt dug around the river for water to drink. Ki lo yachlu lishtos mimei hayor, for they could not drink from the water of the river. Vayimalei shiva askamim, and 7 days were filled, between 7 days passed, acharei hakos Hashem es hayor, after God struck the river. So this is the plague of blood. It was a 7-day plague. Moshe and Aaron, Moshe tells Paro this is what's going to happen. Paro doesn't listen. Hashem tells Moshe to tell Aaron to strike the water, or stretch out his hand over the water, and all the water turns into blood. Clearly there is water accessible to the Egyptians, because if there was no water accessible to the Egyptians, besides the fact that they would all die from thirst, because a person can't go 7 days without drinking, so there must be some water that's accessible to the Egyptians. But more than that, it says that the sorcerers of Egypt also turned water into blood. They couldn't do that unless there was water. So they must have had access to some water that they could turn into blood. And furthermore, the Torah says that the Egyptians dug around the river to find water to drink. Apparently, even though all the water turned into blood, but any new water that they were able to unearth, that remained as water. So there was water available, but all of the available water in Egypt, when Moshe and Aaron performed or brought about the plague of blood, at that moment all the water in Egypt turned to blood. It didn't matter whether it was in the Nile River, whether it was in a canal that had been dug to irrigate the fields from the Nile River, whether it was in a pool of water that had been gathered, whether it was in somebody's pitcher or somebody's glass or cup, everything turned into blood. All of the Egyptians' water turned into blood. We know from the Midrashim and from later on that the Jews were unaffected. All the water the Jews had did not turn to blood, but all the Egyptians' water turned into blood. How did the Egyptians then get water? So one method was to dig new wells, and if they dug a new well and uncovered new water, that water was not blood, it was water. As you can imagine, that is a labor-intensive thing to do, to dig new wells, which many of them did, but you're talking about a nation of, I imagine, millions of people who now had nothing to drink. And so to dig wells, first of all, it's a very difficult thing to do, and second of all, how many wells can you dig already to find water? That's number one. And number two, the Medrash tells us, this is what you're going to say, the Medrash tells us that they were able to purchase water from the Jewish people. Right. That if they, what's that?
I was just going to say that it's really a mida keneged mida, because now the Egyptians are turned into slaves.
That's correct. Now the Egyptians had to perform back-breaking labor to save their own lives. Otherwise they would die of thirst. So they needed to dig wells, which they did, and they needed to purchase water from the Jews. The Medrash says that if the Egyptian would grab water away from a Jew, because since they were the masters and the Jews were the slaves, so if they would grab water away from a Jew, the water would immediately turn into blood. Not only that, but even if a Jew was drinking water from a cup, if the Egyptian would put his mouth to the same cup and attempt to drink simultaneously with the Jew would be drinking water and the Egyptian would get blood in his mouth. And the only way for the Egyptian to actually get water would be to purchase the water from the Jew. This enriched the Jewish people and impoverished the Egyptians. And also, the digging of the water was, as we said, back-breaking labor.
So did the work of the Jews slow down?
The Medrash says that from the moment of the first plague, the work stopped. From that point on, the Jews were not worked again until we left. So even though there was time between plagues, but once the plague started, the Egyptians laid off. It was too dangerous to start bothering the Jews anyway, the Egyptians themselves were so harried by the plagues, they were unable to maintain the system of the organized system of slavery. Slavery requires a great deal of organization. Of you have to have people who are in charge of other people and working out who's got to do what and who's got what where. It wasn't, you're talking with a nation of Jews. It wasn't just one slave or two slaves. You're talking about millions of Jews and the Egyptians enslaving them. Once there was a week where the Jews were completely free of working, because the Egyptians had no ability to work, the Jews at that point, then that ended the slavery for all intents and purposes. The Jews were not free yet, but the backbreaking labor stopped with the beginning of the plagues. Yes?
Egyptians.
Okay, so you're drawing from that phrase, le'enei pharaoh, to the eyes of pharaoh, that which they could see.
It might mean more than...
Okay, well, we can deal with that. I mean, the le'enei to the eyes of usually means that he did it in front of them, in the presence of, right. But I accept that. That's a nice explanation to say that it means what they could see.
It could have been al-pnei.
Right, or lifnei,
or whatever.
Right, something like that. Something like that. Now, before we discuss the staff of Moshe and the staff of Aaron, which is really what I want to focus on this evening, I want to cover a few more things about the Makkah of Blood so that we can at least cover the entire thing this evening. Paro does not need Hashem's help to harden his heart. Paro hardens his own heart and refuses to be affected by the plague of blood. That's a very difficult thing to do. His sorcerers managed to copy what Moshe and Aaron had done, so that gives Paro a little bit of confidence that this might be just very, very powerful magic, and it has nothing to do with Hashem. But he really has to work at it, as we see from Pasuk Chaf Gimel, verse 23, after the Torah says that Paro hardened his heart and did not listen to the Jew, to Hashem, did not listen to Moshe and Aaron as Hashem had predicted. Then it says, Paro turned and came to his house and did not put his heart even to this. Paro made a concerted effort not to allow himself to be affected by the plague. Very often things happen and we clearly are meant to take notice. When things happen in the world or things happen immediately around us, the expectation that Hashem has of us is that we notice it and we react to it. When a person does not react, it's a dangerous thing, because that means a person is saying, I won't pay attention to this message. Well, then Hashem has to, God forbid, bring a stronger message. Because if a person doesn't listen to the first one, Hashem's got to get his attention in a different way.
It shows arrogance also.
Well, sometimes it just shows apathy. Sometimes it shows apathy, sometimes it shows arrogance. But there can be things that happen where it's impossible not to react. It's impossible not to react. You can't not react to 9/11. When it happened, you couldn't just ignore it. It would really be difficult to ignore it. A person would have to actually make a decision, I'm going to ignore it. I am not going to let this change my life in any way. Meaning, not just how I go about my business, but even the way I think. I'm not going to allow myself to transform the way I think from pre-9/11 to post-9/11. Now, as we all know, that's impossible. The way we live our lives has changed dramatically, particularly in how we travel. But also, our complacency about terrorism and our complacency about how things are working in the world, the fact that the United States itself went to war because of it, and the way that things have gone on since then. But so for a person to pretend nothing ever happened, for a person to look at the New York skyline and pretend there still is a World Trade Center there, would take an incredible effort. A person can do it. We can deceive ourselves into anything. And a person could theoretically do it, but it's very, very difficult. That's what Paro did. Paro took an event as as cataclysmic, as incredible as 9/11, and made a concerted effort. He made a decision. I am not going to let this affect me in the least. And he turned his back and went to his palace. And as far as he was concerned, business as usual. Nothing has changed. That's what Paro did.
Mind-boggling.
It's fantastic. But that's what Paro did. Paro is not letting go of his statement, Mi Hashem Asher Eshma B'Kolo. Who is Hashem that I have to listen to him? I never heard of this Hashem. Don't know that one. And I'm not paying attention. That's what Paro is doing. The Rambam writes that if God forbid, a tragedy occurs, then we Jews have to react. And the Rambam writes, Maimonides writes, that if a Jew does not react, then Mrs. Starkman said it's arrogance. I suggested apathy. The Rambam says it's cruelty. It's cruel not to react. Fascinating approach. Why is it cruel? So the commentaries explain, because since Hashem brings things in order for people to react, that doesn't mean that it's a punishment. But whatever it is, if something happens, we are meant to react to it. And as I said before, if God forbid we don't react, then Hashem needs to get our attention in another, more powerful way, which we don't want. So it's cruel because it precipitates a stronger message, which we don't want. And that is a cruel thing. It's a cruel thing to just stand by and say, I'm not going to react, knowing that the next step is going to be even worse. Paro here says, I'm not going to let this affect me. And of course, as we know, the plagues now escalate. And they move from blood to frogs, etc., until the death of the firstborn. So Paro is not going to let this affect him, and because of that, there's going to be an escalation in the plagues.
Is it more cruel to himself or to others?
The Rambam is talking about to others. But here, I mean, Paro is just ignoring it. Now, we know had Paro chosen to pay attention, Hashem would have hardened Paro's heart. He already told Moshe he's going to harden Paro's heart. But Hashem didn't have to. Just show you how far Paro goes, that it's going to take five full plagues. It's not until the sixth plague where we're going to find that Paro actually needs Hashem's help in hardening his heart. That's how stubborn he is in the way he thinks. In the plague of dam, of blood, so Hashem brings it against Paro. And as we said, Paro ignores it. Now, the way that it happens is with Moshe and Aaron with their staffs and striking the water, or stretching out their staff over the water. So let's start with the thing which I think most everyone is familiar with, which is, you notice in the first paragraph about the blood to the second paragraph, we change from Moshe being the one who's going to bring about the plague to Aaron bringing about the plague. This is a relatively well-known thing, that the first three plagues, Dam Tzvadei Akinim, blood, frogs, and lice, were not brought about by Moshe, but rather by Aaron. Even though, in the first paragraph, starting with Pasuk Yudal 14, and moving until through Yurches through 18, Moshe is saying to Paro that I am going to stretch my hand out, and Hashem told Moshe that he should strike the water. Let's take, for example, Pasuk Yudzai, verse 17. So says Hashem, with this you will know that I am Hashem. Behold, I, meaning I, Moshe, will strike with the staff that is in my hand on the water that is in the river, and it will turn to blood. So Moshe is saying that I, Moshe, am going to do it. Yet, in Pasuk Yudzai, verse 19, it changes. Hashem says to Moshe, tell Aaron, take your staff and stretch your arm out over the waters of Egypt, and it will all turn into blood. Pasuk Chav, verse 20, first starts in the plural. that Moshe and Aaron both did as God had commanded, but then it switches to the singular. Vayarem bamatehi, singular, stretched out with his staff. Vayachas amayim, and he, singular, struck the water that was in the river in front of Paro, in front of his servants, and it turned to blood. So our sages tell us, Chazal say, that the reason why it changes, why it couldn't be Moshe who would strike the water or the sand, because the plagues of blood and of tzvardea and of frogs were brought about by striking the water, and the plague of kinim of lice was brought about by striking the sand. And the reason why Moshe couldn't do those things is because Moshe had a debt of gratitude to the water and to the sand, because it was through the water that Moshe was saved from death, because his mother put him in a teva, in a little box, and put him in the water. That's how she avoided the sword of the or the clutches of the searchers of Paro, who would go around looking for Jewish baby boys and throw them in the river. So she put him in a box in the river. So the river saved Moshe. And with the sand, when Moshe later got older and he killed an Egyptian, in order to cover up the evidence, Moshe buried the Egyptian in the sand. So the sand came to Moshe's rescue and the water came to Moshe's rescue. And as a result, Moshe could not strike the water and could not strike the sand, and therefore Aaron had to do it instead of Moshe. The reason why most everyone is familiar with this Gemara is because it is the subject of many a sermon, because the obvious question is, the water doesn't have feelings, the sand doesn't have feelings, how do you owe a debt of gratitude to an inanimate object, to water and to sand? They didn't do anything for you, you used them for your own benefit, but they didn't do anything for you. And most of the commentaries approach this with a general pronouncement about what it means to have gratitude, that one has to be a person who has gratitude towards everything and everybody, and even things, even if a person does something for you but it is inadvertent, or the person doesn't even know they did it for you, but if you benefited from somebody else, you have to have gratitude and you have to be indebted to that person. Doesn't make a difference whether the person meant to do anything for you, even if the person knows they did anything for you, but if you gained because of someone else, then you have to have a debt of gratitude. And Moshe here, it's not that the Moshe is thanking the water, it's not that Moshe is thanking the sand, Moshe is not getting down and kissing the sand, Moshe is not offering a sacrifice, God forbid, to the sand or to the water. Moshe understands that it was Hashem's help and using the water and the sand into Moshe's benefit, but Moshe is teaching us a lesson, or Hashem is teaching us a lesson, by not letting Moshe strike the water or the sand, how much gratitude we have to have, and how all-encompassing Hakaras Hatov gratitude is, that it covers everything. We have to be the type of people that notice what we get from other people and notice what we get from others, and not to be selfish and not to think that we are self-sufficient and that we can survive on our own. Really in stark contrast to Paro himself, who believes that he is in control of his own destiny. We know that we are not independent people. We are very, very dependent on HaKadosh Baruch Hu and on each other, and we need all the help we can get. Nevertheless, it is striking that Hashem has Moshe go out to Paro and tell Paro, I am going to strike the water with the staff that is in my hand. And then Hashem tells Moshe, tell Aaron, you do it. Clearly, the plague was supposed to be brought about by Moshe. And it is only, I don't want to say it's an afterthought, because of course Hashem knew what he was doing, but it is presented to us as an afterthought, that Moshe threatens Paro himself with Moshe's staff, and then Hashem says to Moshe, oh, what was that? Don't do it. Tell Aaron to do it. That's the way it's presented in the Chumash. Now, we mentioned that Moshe's staff had turned into a snake, and that was back in Parsha Shmos, when Moshe said, Vehein lo yaminu li, they, the Jews, will not believe me. They will say, God never appeared to you. And Hashem turned to Moshe and said to him, Ma zeh biyadecha, what is this in your hand? Vayomer mateh, he said, it's a staff. And we know Chazal say, "Maze biyadecha." What is the sin that is now in your hand? You just spoke lashon hara about the Jewish people. You said they're not going to believe you. That is a form on Moshe's level. That is a form of lashon hara. And so Hashem says to Moshe, "Hashlichehu arza, throw that staff down to the ground. Throw that sin away. Vayashlichehu arza, I threw it down. Vayihilin alchash, and it turned into a snake. Vayyanas Moshe mipanav. Moshe ran away from before that snake." Hashem says to Moshe, "You acted like the snake. The snake spoke lashon hara. The original snake with Chava spoke lashon hara, characterizing Hashem as conniving and trying to keep Adam and Chava from being godlike by preventing them from eating from the tree. And so the snake used lashon hara, evil speech. So you, Moshe, you acted like a snake, and therefore you now are in danger of being bitten by a snake." And the snake now chases Moshe, and Moshe runs away. Then Hashem says to Moshe, "Shlach yotcha ve'echoz biznavo," reach out and grab its tail. And he does, and it turns back into a staff. That was the staff of Moshe. Here, in Pasuk Tesvav 15, Hashem says to Moshe, "Lechal paro baboka," go to paro in the morning. "Hinei ozei ha'maima," behold, he's going out to the water. "V'nitzav heli krosol asfas hayar," you shall stand to greet him at the riverbank. "V'hamateh asher nepach l'nachash," that staff that turned into a snake, "tikach biyadecha," take in your hands. There is no reason to write asher nepach l'nachash, that turned into a snake. Moshe knew which staff was his. His staff had turned into a snake. Why does Hashem emphasize, take the staff that had turned into a snake?
Into a nachash.
But why, okay, good, not a tanin, a nachash. Why emphasize that?
So you shouldn't speak again lashon hara by the Jews?
Okay, so you're saying it's a message to Moshe. Okay? Is there another way to understand it?
Well, the last staff just mentioned is Aaron's staff.
Correct.
So this is pointing up the fact that we have left the subject of Aaron's staff.
Okay. Okay, so we are moving away. The last story was the story of Aaron's staff turning into a tanin, a serpent, a sea serpent, not an achash, not a snake. And now Hashem says, Moshe, you take the staff, not the one we just had in the last paragraph. You take the other staff, the one that turned into a snake. But Mrs. Kaiser just said, and perhaps it is a message to Paro.
But how would he have known? Because he would have known at the burning bush that it turned into a nachash, not a tani.
Okay.
All he saw was Aaron's that turned into
okay.
a tani.
Okay, good. So, Aaron's staff turns into a tanin. Now, what is a tanin? It is also a snake or a serpent, but it is aquatic. We know this because back in the 6 days of creation, that's the first time the word tanim is mentioned. Vayivra Elokim es hataninim hagidolim. Hashem created the great taninim, which is a sea creature, a huge sea creature. The taninim are the subject of a lot of medrash, and it's the kind of thing which we don't know much about. Very Kabbalistic. What do we know about the taninim? So, the Gemara tells us, and most of this, I will say in advance, we're not going to understand, but it's going to give us a picture of what we're talking about. The Gemara says the taninim are massive sea creatures. They are serpent-like, and they are sea creatures. And they're huge, far larger than anything else that we can picture. Larger than the largest whale, gigantic creatures. The fact that modern zoology, or I don't know what the study of oceans are, oceanography, oceanology,
marine biology,
mm-hmm. Okay, haven't detected these things does not prove anything. It's just that right now they are hidden. But it's more than that. It's because there is only one left. Because Hashem created two, male and female. And the Gemara says that Hashem created the male and the female tanin, as a taninim hagidolim, plural, the two of them. And then Hashem And then Hashem slaughtered, shechted, killed the female tanim and salted it to preserve it for the future. Why did Hashem kill the female tanim? Because had Hashem, the Gemara says, had Hashem left it alive, they would have procreated, and if the taninim would have procreated, they would have taken over the world. They were so large that they would have destroyed everything else. Everything else wouldn't have been able. They would have used all the resources on the planet for themselves. And so Hashem had to stop that. Therefore, he killed the female tanim, salted it for the future. What does it mean for the future? Because in the future, Hashem is going to serve the meat of the taninim to the tzaddikim, to the righteous.
Is this a Leviathan?
That's the Leviathan, the Leviathan.
Oh, that's it, yeah.
That's what it is. That's what the tanim are.
Leviathan is what was killed?
There's a male and a female.
Right.
And Hashem killed the female, left the male alive, so the male is still there, still around somewhere.
Okay.
And in the future, the meat of the Leviathan, both the female one, which has been salted and is preserved, and the male one, which will be slaughtered at that time, will be served to the tzaddikim. There will be the Seudas Leviathan, the feast of the Leviathan, which is discussed in Sukkis, is when you talk about it a little bit, and it will be served in the future. And the hide, the skin of the Leviathan, Hashem will use as a sukkah. He will make into a sukkah under which the tzaddikim will sit in the shade and eat this feast.
It's not like, excuse my ignorance, the Loch Ness monster.
Well, clearly that myth is building on this.
Yeah.
Right? One can ask, so then why bother creating the male and the female if you're going to then kill the female because they can't procreate? So then don't create it in the first place. What is this? What is going on over here? And what's this business of a feast in the future with this? I mean, the whole thing is clearly very Kabbalistic and beyond our understanding in many, many ways. But that is the Tanin. The Nachash, the original snake, as we know, is the one that tried to get, that got Chava and then Adam to eat from the Eitz Hadas, from the tree, and brought death to the world. When one thinks of the Nachash, one thinks of the first sin. That's what one thinks of. The Nachash, the snake, there is a major discussion about that original snake, because the snake talks, the snake reasons, it walks. So what was this snake? Is it that the Chava knows or understands the language of snakes? Or is the snake able to speak in human language? Does the snake have its own reasoning? Is it an angelic thing? What is going on over there? We don't know. There's a great debate about that. But whatever it is, the snake represents the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. The snake is the one that whispers in Chava's ear to get her to sin, and she succumbs, as does Adam. The snake represents sin. And therefore, the snake then now represents retribution for sin. Moshe sins on his level, speaks Lashon Hara. Hashem says, throw down that sin, it turns into a snake, and Moshe has to run away. A snake today represents retribution for sin, punishment for sin. The taninim, which are also snakes, but they're sea serpents, evidently they are kosher, because it's going to be served to the tzaddikim in the future. The taninim represent, when you think back to the original taninim, they represent reward, because it's going to be the feast for the tzaddikim, for the righteous in the future. So where the snake, the Nachash, and the Tanim are both snake-like creatures, they look similar, I imagine, meaning I'm not talking about the Taninim in its huge form, but a smaller one, I would imagine has a similar appearance to a Nachash, to a snake, but one represents punishment, that's the Nachash, one represents reward. The Taninim, I'm giving you one explanation as to why Hashem created a male and female, even though He was not going to let them procreate, is because why do they represent reward? What is this feast in the future? Because the Taninim are huge, powerful creatures. They represent bracha. They represent blessing. They represent the fact that Hashem created a creature that is powerful, strong, mighty, huge.
Abundance, maybe?
That if it would have procreated, it would have taken over the world. That is Hashem's abundance, Hashem's bounty, that the Taninim represent. Hashem didn't let them do it. He killed the female immediately. Didn't let them procreate. But they represent the incredible bracha that can be showered upon the world. And in the future, the tzaddikim, the righteous, who did what they were supposed to do during the time that they were meant to do it, then they will reap that bracha, they will reap that incredible blessing of Hashem and actually partake of that taninim, of that livyasan, of that feast in the future, and have the shade over their head, etc. The two staffs, that of Moshe and that of Aaron, one represents retribution and one represents reward. They're two sides of the same coin, the Nachash and the Livyasan. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Sanhedrin, the Gemara says that two people come to judgment. Two people have a dispute over money, financial matters, and they come before a Beis Din. In front of a Beis Din, the Beis Din, the court of law, has to paskin the halacha and has to say, this is the halacha. This person is correct, this person is incorrect, and whatever happens, happens. The Beis Din cannot show mercy. A Beis Din cannot play favorites. A Beis Din has to say straight, this is what happened, this is what the Torah says. After going through all the different angles, figuring out what really happened, and then saying, this is the ruling of the Torah. The language of the Gemara is very powerful. Yikov hadin es hahar. The din, the law, should bore through the mountain. Nothing stands in its way. When that law is paskin, is ruled upon, it bores through the mountain. It just does what it does. It can cause havoc, wreak havoc in its path. People get hurt. This person loses his money. This person goes home angry. But it doesn't make a difference. The halacha, the law, is the law. You can't do anything about it. And the Gemara says, that was what Moshe would say. Yikov hadin es hahar. Then the Gemara says, but Aaron said differently. Aaron was ohev shalom verodev shalom. He loved peace and he chased after peace. Umevi shalom ben aron lachaver. And he brought peace between man and his fellow man. And then a pasuk is said about Aaron, what he would say, a verse that refers to Aaron. The Gemara does not mean to suggest that Aaron and Moshe had a difference of opinion. Moshe had a role to play, and Moshe's role was to speak the word of Hashem. And the word of Hashem is clear and unwavering. This is the law. And if you're going to fight and you're going to have to come to court, then be prepared for the law. Aaron's role was, let's not go to court. Let's work this out. And let's not go to court. Let's make shalom. Let's avoid that. Because if you go to court, someone gets hurt. We don't want people to get hurt. Let's have shalom. It's not a disagreement. It's two different roles. Aaron's role was to keep people out of court. Moshe's role was, once they're in court, you got to have a law. And the law is the law. And there's no way to bend it. It is what it is. Moshe's staff is that staff of the law. If you transgressed and you're here with transgressing and you remain, not you, a person remains in their sin and is unwilling to change and wants to face the court of law, the heavenly court of law, they're going to get smacked. Aaron's role is, let's not face that court of law. Let's make shalom. Let's avoid that. Let's not end up in the court of law. Now, let's be clear. This does not mean to say that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't advocate for tshuva. After all, remember, Moshe Rabbeinu saved our necks on more than one occasion where he begged for mercy from Hashem, where Hashem says, I'm going to wipe out all the Jewish people, both with the golden calf and with the spies, and Moshe saved us. It's not that Moshe didn't have mercy when it was necessary. But the role that he played on a daily basis was one of the law. And the role that Aaron played on a daily basis was one of, let's avoid having to have that law. The staffs they carried were similar. Moshe's staff turns into a snake because Moshe's staff is the one of retribution. Aaron's staff turns into a tanim because Aaron's staff is that of reward, of let's avoid retribution. Let's remember what this world is all about, where we're headed, where we're going. And we're here for a purpose, and let's remember there is Hashem. When Moshe comes before Paro for the plague of Dam of Blood, Hashem says to Moshe, take the staff. Which staff? The staff that turned into a snake. Your ultimatum to Paro is that of retribution. Paro, you want to harden your heart? You're going to get smacked, and you're going to get smacked good and hard. Take that staff with you. And he does. And he threatens Paro with that staff. You're correct, Paro didn't have no way of knowing the staff turned into a snake. But it's the symbolism that we're being told. Moshe spoke to Paro harshly to say, you're going to get smacked. But in the end, Moshe doesn't do the smacking. In the end, for the first three plagues, it's Aaron that does it. Which staff does Aaron use? One could argue that Moshe handed Aaron Moshe's staff. But I think that the simple reading is that instead, Aaron used his own staff to strike the water and to strike the sand. Which means that although it was still a plague and it still hurt, but it was being done with a different perspective. It was being done with the intention of correcting Paro and trying to get him to see that that's not the way to behave. Let's.
Oh, sorry. Did you get it?
Using the staff to use the plague to correct, to get Paro and the Egyptians to see that HaKadosh Baruch Hu really is in charge, and let's avoid all of the future pain and suffering that's going to fall upon the Egyptians because of their behavior. It was a different approach than Moshe's. I'm not suggesting that the plague was any less powerful, but it was done with a different intention. Rather than just to punish, it was done to correct.
So you kind of think din as opposed to chesed?
Yes, yes.
Rachamim, din as opposed to rachamim.
Now, but Chazal don't say this. Chazal, our sages, say the reason why Moshe didn't do it was because of the fact that the water saved him and because of the fact that the sand saved him. That's why it switched from Moshe to Aaron. Evidently, because there is a debt of gratitude that we have to Egypt, Moshe was saved by the water. Moshe was saved by the sand. Who was he saved from? He was saved from the Egyptians, who were going to kill him. But nevertheless, he was saved. So as a result, the focus of the first three plagues is not the same as it was going to be. Rather than being one of din, of judgment, of pure retribution, it is one which has an element of rachamim, which has an element of wake up and smell the coffee. Let's think about the future. Let's think about the Su'udas Liv Yasam. Let's think about that feast in the future. We can be part of that.
The Egyptians can be part of that?
The Egyptians can have their role. As anybody has, everybody has a role to play. Even non-Jews have a role to play.
Yeah.
It's not the same role. The Torah itself tells us, later on in Parashas Kisetze, that there are certain nations that can never join the Jewish people, can never marry into the Jewish people. We've talked about this before. The Moavim and the Ammonim, the men can never marry into the Jewish people. Even if they convert, they can't marry a regular Jewish woman. But the Egyptians can after three generations. Even though they enslaved us, and they beat us, and they drowned our boys, nevertheless, the Egyptians, after three generations, meaning if a person converts, an Egyptian converts, at that point they cannot marry a regular Jewish woman. They can marry another convert, they can marry a mamzer, but they can't marry a regular Jewish woman. After three generations of not marrying a regular Jewish woman, the final product can marry a regular Jewish woman.
The third or the fourth?
That's a discussion in the Gemara.
Oh,
exactly.
Okay.
What point it is. But at that point, they can marry. By all rights, the Egyptians should be barred from joining the Jewish people, because they were terrible to us. And the Torah says, you know why the Egyptians can join after three generations? Ki ger hayisa v'artso. Because you were a stranger in his land. As Rashi over there says, they hosted you. They beat you, they drowned your kids, but they hosted you. You did benefit from the Egyptians. You were in their land, you ate their food, you benefited from their land. And therefore, there is some element of hakaras hatov, of gratitude that we have to show the Egyptians. And that is reflected in the law of the Torah that the Egyptians can join after three generations. That is reflected here. The first three plagues say that even though they were horrible to you, but because there is some small measure of gratitude that we have to have, which is represented by Moshe, who has gratitude to the inanimate water and inanimate sand, we also have gratitude on some small level that at least they did host us. And that's why the first three plagues are not with the staff that turned into a snake, which was Moshe's staff, but rather with the staff of Aaron that turned into a tanin. And therefore it's less harsh. However that manifests itself, which I don't know. Whether, I said before, it was the exact same plague, maybe it was a little less harsh. I don't know how it manifested itself. But the intent of the plague was to correct rather than to punish. After the first three plagues, then we move away from that. That's already, that Aaron has played his role, and now we move away into either Hashem doing it or Moshe doing it, or whatever it is. We'll see later how the other plagues work. That's what I think is going on with the contrast of the staffs. I would just like to mention to you, we're out of time, but I want to mention to you that those of you who studied Yechezkel with us might remember that in the 28th parak of Yechezkel,
yeah, right,
which was class number 62, which took place on March the 4th of 2009, you like my prodigious memory? I looked it up before we came in.
Thank you, Killian.
Yeah, thank you. Right, thank you, Sir Killian. So in that class, we talked about the psukim over there, which are talking about how Yechezkel has a prophecy about Egypt, how just as Nebuchadnezzar came and conquered Israel, so too he would then come and conquer Egypt. And there it says that Paro, you say that the river is yours, the Nile is yours, Li Yo'ori, the Nile is mine, Vani Asisini, and I made myself. I am everything. So Hashem says, I'm going to get you. I'm going to take a hook is like a fisherman. I'm going to take a hook and I'm going to hook you and take you out of the river. That's what Hashem says about Paro. I'm going to bring Nebuchadnezzar to smack you. Over there, when Paro is referenced, he is called Hatanim Hagadol, the great serpent, the great Tanim, Harovetz Besochia Orav, that crouches in his river. Paro there is called a Tanim. At the time, in the class we spoke of then, at that time, we didn't make this contrast. We only mentioned that Paro is likened to this massive creature. I wondered, when I was preparing tonight's class, why Paro would be referred to as the Tanim over there. Really, either one that would have been used, either Nachash or Tanim, would have to have an explanation, because there Paro is being compared to it. Over here, it's the staff that is being compared to either the Nachash or the Tanim. Over there in Yechezkel, Paro is being called the Tanim. So it seems to me that, at least in the light of what we spoke about this evening, it seems to me that Paro over there fancied himself as being the source of all blessing. He fancied himself as being the one who made the river run, who brought bounty to the Egyptians. Therefore, he considered himself to be the Tanim Hagadol, the great Tanim, the one who is all, the massive creature, the one who is, represents all sorts of blessing. That was Paro who saw himself in that way. And Hashem says to him, you're not so great, and I'm going to cut you down. That's why I think that the phrase Tanim Hagadol is used for Paro. But whatever we're going to say, if one wants to have a different approach to Tanim and Nachash, of course there are many other ways of explaining things, one has to take into account that reference to Paro as being the Tanim HaGadol, the great Tanim, the great serpent, the great snake, sea snake, that is in his river in the Yar. Right, that brings us to Sfardea, which will miss be next time.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the Donate link. Thank you very much.